Now, why would you call me David?
I like David. You know, I'll just say something about me if you want to record this. A lot of people from different parts of the country, like my neighbor next door, he likes to call me Andy.
Oh.
I never tell anybody my name is Andy. I always tell them my name is Andrew. See, so Dave is a shortening of David. So maybe that's where I'm coming from, you know, David.
You want to go with the full name by default. Yeah,
and then some people say Davey, you know.
My aunt always said Davey. Yeah, so, like Davy Crockett.
I like David, even though I'll call you Dave, you know, most of the time, but sometimes I'll say David.
Well, I appreciate that.
Cause to me,
as long as you're saying my name, I'm thrilled.
David, to me, is more respectful. That's all.
And professional.
And professional. I like David.
Okay. Sounds good. Hi, this is Dave Douglas. You can call me David, and this is the Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. This is a very special episode with the drummer, composer, philosopher, Andrew Cyril. As soon as this interview was over, I realized we could easily do a second episode with Mr. Cyril. There were so many things I had hoped to talk about, and so limited time. Also, Andrew went a lot of directions I didn't even anticipate, and so there were a lot of new things I learned. I wanted to ask him about Mary Lou Williams, and we never really got to it. So, possible episode 2. Thanks for all your emails about this show at podcast@greenleafmusic.com, and you can support the Greenleaf Music community as a subscriber at greenleafmusic.com. So, come and join us. Here's Andrew Cyril. Enjoy.
Broba, man, that's the pre-beauty.
Yeah, yeah.
So
Wadada Leo Smith.
Yeah, and Bill
and Frizzell. And you.
Yeah. So
I think it's beautiful.
I think so too.
It's so beautiful. You had to name it twice.
You mean Pretty Beauty?
Yeah.
Well, that came from a. It came from an idea that I had about just pretty little girls. And, you know, when I wrote it, I thought about kids, you know, maybe like 3, 4, 5, even though, you know, my daughter is much older now. But when they would be dressed up, they would look so pretty and beautiful.
But it's also, I think, you know, from a musical standpoint, it's kind of counterintuitive. The way you play on it is so sparse. And I feel like probably the very conception of the tune had to do with that sparseness, right? Open space. And bringing Bill and Wadada into that space and creating that sound world.
Yeah. But you see, it's not so much that I thought about the space. I thought about what could I do, how could I accompany them in relationship to the melody with what I do on the drums. So that's why you hear, did you say sparseness?
Yeah.
That's in essence why it's so sparse. I mean, I could have played that piece with a number of other utensils and had them, and when I say utensils, you know, like I mean sticks or brushes or mallets or, you know, some other knitting needles, whatever it is that we percussionists use to get sound.
Yeah.
I could have used any one of those other items, but I thought in order for me to do what I needed to do as a drummer in a relationship to the muted sound of the trumpet and to what Bill was going to do eventually would give a much better mesh, you know, a something that would be, how can I say,
well, it's a compositional approach.
Yeah, but the reason is, even though it's a compositional approach, the point becomes why the compositional approach. And the compositional approach had to do with the fact that I did not necessarily want to obfuscate what they were playing in relationship to what I was doing. See, there are other compositions on this CD that have me do other things for certain reasons.
Right. See,
but for this pretty beauty, I did not want it to be something that was turbulent. I mean, just to, you know, use that term and due to lack of another one, or to be too busy.
Yeah.
You see.
But I also get the feeling from listening to this record that, you know, so much of it is happening in real time that it doesn't sound over-rehearsed. So, like, I wonder, in your opinion, how much preparation is too much preparation and how much is enough?
Well, I had an idea of what I wanted in terms of sound. Now, Wadada is somebody who does not like to play compositions over and over again. He's not a take one, take two, take three person.
Yeah.
So he does what he does, and it comes out that way. So as far as the preparation was concerned, we had a rehearsal, gave him music, told him what I wanted. He played it. We played it through once, maybe twice, and that was it.
Yeah.
See, so insofar as what I wanted from beginning to end is what it is that you hear in relationship to what the title of the composition had to do and the concept of the title, which had to do with little pretty girls.
I feel like Bill is this, well, maybe not, I don't want to say a similar kind of player, but somebody that doesn't need a lot of takes, let's say, to get the feeling of the tune right. So the fact that you had one rehearsal and gave them the music probably gave you the confidence as the person who thought of it that you could walk in and do one, maybe two takes.
Right. So I give them the score. But a lot of times what you hear is not altogether what's written. See, so what happens is what they do is they embellish.
Yeah, yeah.
in terms of what it is that they see.
And you also, I mean, from the sound of it, a supreme interaction and listening.
Oh, yeah.
And just, okay, let me take this moment as a pure expression based on this music that Andrew wrote for this date.
Yeah, you see, written music, you know, has its place, and it is important in a lot of ways. But a lot of times when scores are given to drummers, they're just guides. So a lot of guys would just say to me, you don't necessarily play what's on the page.
Yeah.
Play what's on the page, but add and subtract things, you know, that makes the music come out to what it is that...
Sometimes they don't even give you a chart.
That's right. See, to know...
I did that on some of the pieces, on the thing that we did together, and I was pretty happy with your reading.
Yeah, but you know, but I've done a lot of things with you. We don't have to start talking about you, because we could talk about you if you want me to talk about you.
No,
right?
No.
Okay.
No, but when you talk about, you know, written music and what's on the page and, you know, developing things in real time and dealing with musicians with personalities that are going to share that and bring that to the music, you know, that opens up a whole world that really brings together the idea of improvisation and composition, and where does there's no fine line between, you know, it's just everything together.
What is it all about exactly?
What I was thinking in relation to what I would want to ask you then is, as somebody, you've been playing for a fair amount of time over the years, so like, how does that differ from your earliest experiences as a musician, if at all?
Well, you're asking me a very interesting question.
Well, thank you. I thought it up myself.
Well, I'll try to answer it.
Well, I appreciate that.
You see, when I started playing by ear.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't reading. So you have a lot of musicians, in a sense, you know, who never read, who played by ear. Wilbur Ware was one of those mm-hmm. bassists, you know, who did that. So the thing is, and look, you have a number of drummers, now I'm not going to mention names, who don't read, but they can play their butts off.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because one could say they kind of like have a photographic memory. See, they can remember things. The only problem is that sometimes when compositions become so arranged with so many different sections and parts and things after start and stop on a dime, mm-hmm. sometimes you need to know how to read in order to do what you need to do so that you come out in the right place or you stop in the right place. So as far as I was concerned, I'm playing, you know, these tunes, you know, Name Tunisia, I'm playing Well You Needn't, and I'm hearing these things with the musicians that I started playing with earlier in life. And I'm playing them by ear. So you're playing over and over. Like most societies, I think we all begin to learn music by ear as kids. Written music only came much later on. You see, and written music is good. It's just like learning how to read and write. Mm-hmm. But there's some societies where people just don't have a script. See, so they learn, you know, from the information being passed down from one generation to another. You know, mm-hmm. like, for instance, you talk about Africa and you talk about griots, et cetera. So they land. And you have some societies, like for instance in India, where you will have a family, and everybody in the family, you know, learns the music, and how they learn the music is through a certain kind of oral tradition. Okay, so as far as getting back to your question and being able to give them the music for them to play, a lot of times Bill and Wadada were adding or subtracting to the notes that I gave them.
Right.
Which is very often what a lot of players who play the other instruments, the diatonic instruments, you might say, they'll say to the drummer, oh, you hear it.
Right.
So I'm hearing it, and then, of course, I'm doing what I need to do as far as drums are concerned,
yeah,
in relationship to what they know or what they feel should be done by the drums in relationship to what the composition is. So it's the same thing with something like Pretty Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
See, so, yeah, Bill played, I would say, 85 to 90% of all the stuff that I had him do. But there's some things that you will hear on the CD that are not written.
Right, right, of course. Yeah, yeah. And I guess, you know, the question, I know, like, you were on, was it your first record date with Coleman Hawkins in 1961?
Yeah.
And there must have been charts for that, right?
No.
So you were just playing by ear even in that period.
And I was as scared as hell because I thought, let's say, I can't play with this cat. You know, send him home. And I was shaking. See?
But they didn't send you home. You
know what Coleman Hawkins said to me?
What did he say?
Hello. Goodbye. And the date was in between. He never said a word to me.
Oh. Well, then it must have gone well.
Obviously, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I listened to that recording now, the Hawk Relaxes, and if I had to do it again, I probably would have played a little differently.
Huh.
But all of the stuff that we played on that record, you know, for those tunes, Just a Gigolo, Swing Low, blah, blah, I had played those tunes with other people in different places. So I kind of understood what to do in terms of the mathematics or in terms of the arrangement and in terms of what the drum should do in certain places.
Right, and the time feel and the,
right.
Yeah. And how do you mark the bridge and all these little details.
That's
and because
right.
You came up in Brooklyn where, I mean, it sounds to me from that period, jazz was everywhere, that there were clubs.
There was a lot of clubs. A
lot of people playing. Max Roach was around.
Oh,
and,
yeah. You know, I learned from people like Duke Jordan,
mm-hmm.
You know, Cecil Payne, whom I had gigs with. And not only them, those in a sense came later. There's Leroy Standard and people like those older guys came later. I started with a fellow named Leslie Brathwaite, piano player.
Mm-hmm.
Who was in the neighborhood, and also Eric Gale, a guitar player who played with the group called Stuff.
Sure.
So we had a group, and we would rehearse, like every Saturday we'd go over to Leslie's house.
What neighborhood in Brooklyn was that?
It was like Bedford-Stuyvesant. He lived mm-hmm. on King's, he lived on Bainbridge.
Mm-hmm.
And around Kingston, there used to be a club there called the Kingston Lounge in that neighborhood.
And we're talking about like early to mid-50s, 1950s, right?
It had to be, yeah, it had to be from mid-50s, you know, to late-50s.
Yeah.
Maybe into the early 60s. I tell you what, the people who came on the scene then who were really lighting it up were people like Horace Silver.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis Hayes was playing drums with Horace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you can, how can I say, define that time or say when those dates happened, when that time was, is when I was doing the stuff with Leslie and Eric, and we would sit down and we would be playing, you know, these standard tunes, but not for me, Cheek to Cheek, You know, those things, standards. And then we would play in the neighborhood, you know, for people who like jazz, and some of the young kids there, you know, who were into it, would have us for these gigs, and sometimes we'd play for dances.
Did Horace Silver come through Brooklyn at that time and with Louis Hayes?
Horace Silver had the group.
It would have been with Blue Mitchell and Junior Cook.
Yeah, Louis lived right around the corner from the projects that I lived.
Uh-huh.
See, so I used to sometimes go over to Louis's house and practice with him. We'd practice together.
Wow.
And Max Roach lived right around the corner on Willoughby. Louis, I think, lived on Hart Street. I lived in the projects that Jay-Z grew up in.
Hmm.
But this was before Jay-Z. A
little bit before, right?
Yeah, that was like around Myrtle and Nostrand, Willoughby, Park Avenue. See, so that's kind of where those guys were. Louis was working with Horace. And with that group was Gene Taylor, Teddy Kotick. Gene Taylor was the bass player. No. That was later. Teddy Kotick was the first bass player.
Uh-huh.
Heard Teddy Kotick, Clifford Jordan, Art Farmer.
Wow.
Louis Hayes, Horace Silver. And I used to hear them at this club called the Continental. I'd go there and listen. But even before I heard them in person, I heard the record, Senior Blues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Louis, at that time, must have been around 18, 19 years old. So what I'm saying to you is that, and it was not only Louis. Louis was on the record, but there were a lot of other young people in Brooklyn who played drums. Maurice Brown, there was Arthur Trotman, there was Bobby Hamilton. You know, a number of us who were in the relative same age group, Arthur Trotman, and we would be playing drums and we'd be checking each other out in relationship to who was doing what. Some guys had favorites that they imitated, you know, to learn how to play, to do whatever it is that they wanted to do.
I guess Philly Joe Jones was big then too, right? And you connected with him at a certain point?
I'm trying to give you a period of time. It had to be at an age when I could go into clubs, because Philly Joe sometimes would borrow my drums and I would have to go into the clubs, you know, to get
bring
my
them
drums
in and
to,
set
yeah,
them up.
To get them up, to bring them in and set them up at the end of the night or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so I had to be about 18, 19 years old then. But before then, you know, there was another period before I met Philly Joe, when I met Max, and even before I met Max, I met Willie Jones, the drummer who had worked with Monk and Lester Young. And I had also met Lenny McBrown, the drummer who had worked with Paul Blay, because I think both of them came from Canada, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So both of them were part of a group of older musicians, and the other one was they said Gunga Din, Lee Abrams, drummer who worked
name.
With Lena with Dinah Washington, and he also worked with Lester Young. So, I mean, he was one of those people that were down in the school where the rehearsals were being made or had for the Drum and Bugle Corps, of which I joined to begin with, and that's how I started playing snare drum.
Mm-hmm.
See, so after that, I began meeting these other musicians who played the trap set who were into jazz, you know.
Did your Willie Jones. Your family was Haitian, right?
My family, I'm glad you say was, because I got another family now who was not Haitian. Yeah, my mother and father came from Haiti.
Came from Haiti.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, did that have anything to do with your entry into music? any connection at all with Haitian music or that culture, or was it really just being in Brooklyn and what was going on around you?
Well, both. I never learned any music per se. Do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that from any Haitian musicians. All of the music instruction that I've had came from American musicians. Now, in my house, yes, my mother would sometimes play some Haitian music. She would sing some Haitian songs. You know, she would sit me on her knee and sing certain nursery rhymes in Creole. You see, and I had a good time listening to her, and, you know, she teased me and stuff like that, you know, touch my eyes, touch my nose, you know, tease your gloss, your neck, bouche d'argent, and then she'd have her pull her hand back and then try to go after me and tickle me, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so
that's
it was a game.
A vivid memory.
Yeah, right. So and I'd be on her knee. So all I'm saying is that, yeah, I heard that. And of course, too, you know, she would speak Creole with her friends and my aunt, et cetera. And then, of course, she would have these meetings on Sundays, usually maybe once or twice a month, with a group called the Haitian Alliance. And they would come together and they would talk about what was going on in Haiti, and what was going on with some of them who were living here, et cetera. And, you know, just talk about the social situation among the Haitians who were here, see. So in that regard, yes, I did hear Haitian music, see, in the house, from my mother playing certain things and, you know, again, with those nursery rhymes. You know, the other thing about my mother, too, was that she would always sing these American songs like, "Good night, Irene, good night." Mm-hmm. Those were some of her, you know, her favorite things. Maybe if I thought about a few more, you know, I could perhaps sing some of the things that she would just be humming and she would sing to us. She was a John Gambling fan. I don't know if you know who John Gambling was. John Gambling was a guy who came on every morning. I think it was WOR, and he had I don't know if it was the NBC Orchestra, but he had a group of musicians, live musicians, who would be in his studio, who would be playing music, you know, during his show. When he would have the commercials, they would play for the commercials, or they would lead into the commercials, etc. So we would listen to John Gambling practically every morning, because this is how she would wake us up in order for us, you know, to go to school, to get ready to go to school. So what am I saying? I'm saying there was a combination of cultures that I always heard when, you know, I was young. See, when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, you know, being at home. So that, in a sense, is the Haitian connection. And there was one more Haitian connection that I could tell you about, which had to do with a Haitian hand drummer. His name was Alphonse Sembert, and Alphonse, A-L-P-H-O-N-S-E. And Sembert is C-I-M-B-E-R. That's how you pronounce it in French. And what he would do is he would come and play at the Haitian, he would play for the L'Alliance Haïtienne, for the Haitian Alliance, when they would have their meetings. Sometimes they would play records, you know, the 78s, and the people would dance. And then sometimes just Sembert would play the drum and they would dance. So me being 4, 5, 6 years old, I'd just be in there, you know, with my mom and with the rest of the people, that I'd look at him and he'd be playing the drums, and I'd just be running around the place like any other 5 or 6 year old.
So I want to just insert a little bit of music here.
Yeah, man.
Related, yeah, maybe to this, what you've been talking about, maybe not, but it's the title track from this latest ECM record, La Broba.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful piece. La Broba by Andrew Cyril. And it's a beautiful tune, first of all.
Thank you.
But it's also, it's different than the first thing we listened to in the sense that it feels more like a song form and more like, now in the case of this one, you've decided on a specific groove vibe.
Right.
Instrumentationally.
Well, both of them, you know, are to some degree song forms. It all depends on the form that you want to use. This is just an 8-bar blues that...
But do you, how much does, you know, developing the vibe of a tune specifically, I mean, I guess, like you said earlier, you count on the musicians who are there to appropriately embellish and bring life to the piece. But at the same time, you know, you've clearly put some thought into what is the atmosphere of this going to be.
Of course.
So how important is that for you?
Well, as you well know, David, you know, you have to have some idea of what you would like. Now, you find the musicians to bring what you would like to life. So what we have always known, as far as jazz is concerned, is that the people who become the most noted and are the people very often who are appreciated the most have a certain signature. You know, Lester Young, Coleman Hawkins, Miles Davis, Art Blakey, they all have a certain sound, a certain kind of signature. So I knew that Wadada had a certain signature, and I knew that Frizzell had a certain signature. So I had to think about something that would bring we three together so that they would feel comfortable and I would feel comfortable in terms of what it was that I was looking for. And I was looking for a certain feeling, more or less, that could identify, yes, with Wadada coming from Leland, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Me playing the blues all over the place, dances, weddings, bar mitzvahs.
I don't want to sidetrack you, but you once told me you played with Mary Lou Williams.
I played with Mary Lou, not once, I played with Mary Lou Williams a lot of times.
A lot. Okay. Yeah. I would ask you about that, but I don't want to get off this topic
because it's really
interesting.
Because you're talking about La Broba, right? So
yeah.
I'm thinking about how I could bring something together that made me feel that I was coming out of the South, but at the same time, not necessarily being in the South, but getting people who could express that for me. And, yeah, like I just told you, all of those people that I played the blues with, including Mary Lou Williams.
Yeah.
And Frizzell, you know, coming out of Baltimore, Maryland. That's where I got the title from. Leland, Mississippi, Brooklyn, New York, and Baltimore, Maryland. They're all
La Broba.
Like, La Broba. All just first letters, the first three letters of each city.
Yeah. But so, part of that is like leading the band from behind the drums, which people talk about a lot being a challenge, which seems to come naturally to you, at least on this.
Well, you see, again, you know, when I ask people to do certain things for me or with me, I'm looking for their signature. So I got Frizzell's signature, and he played the tune. And as a matter of fact, if you saw the score, what they're playing is not necessarily what was written. It's an approximation. But they got the feeling for what it was that I wanted to do, and of course how I played the drums on this particular piece, just represented something that I wanted to do in terms of, how can I put it? It would have to be how I assigned the rhythms in relationship to meter. The meter is there, but the meter, to some degree, is fractured.
Do you mean how you're assigning them within your own kit, or do you mean among the three players in the band?
Both.
Uh-huh.
And how I'm thinking about playing it on my kit, playing the drums.
Yeah.
In relationship to what it is that they're playing, and how it is that I'm hearing what they're playing in terms of where I want the music to go. So I guess, you know, one could lead by playing a certain rhythm, and you want somebody to play a certain thing, and you want, like, you know, you play Latin Tunisia, and you play the Latin, bang, bang, so you can play that straight, you know, kind of getting four. You could even play it in six against four. But what I'm saying is that what I did was I thought of the meter, but then at the same time, I wasn't automatically thinking about playing one where one would expect to hear one. Now, a lot of times when we play, and especially sometimes with bebop stuff, you play, and guys, and you do this too, you play over the bar line. So the one sometimes is there, but the one is not obvious. So if I'm playing the drums, I don't necessarily have to strike one. I can leave the one out and go to two, or go to the end of three, or whatever it was. But I'm not necessarily thinking about it in terms of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking mm-hmm. about it in terms of sound and what it is that I hear. And then when you hear it back, then you can begin to analyze it in terms of what the numbers
interesting
have yeah. been or are.
Because something I wanted to ask you was, we were both in a session some months ago, maybe a couple of years ago, where we were listening to some young musicians play, and I was sort of cheating, looking over your shoulder, and you had a notebook of handwritten qualities that make good music, and broken down into all kinds of different categories and definitions, and I kept trying to, like, see if I could sneak in and, you know, maybe, like, take a picture of it, and, you know, I'll admit you were a little bit cagey, you were a little proprietary, you were like, no, you can't read this. I said, well, how am I going to learn how to make music if anyway,
with all of the music that you make?
No,
let's not go with you now.
No, but the question that I that this brought up for me as a result of what you just said is, how much are you thinking about all those attributes, all those qualities, all those verities, if you will, while you're playing? And it sounds like maybe only after the fact, or maybe you are thinking about it.
Well, it's both. I think what makes, in a sense, all music come to life and has us celebrate it, I don't care where it comes from, is how it makes us feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So, insofar as what the formulas are that put the music together, it still has to have the impact of making people feel a certain thing. So, as much as you can tell students, do things a certain way, and, you know, they can do them according to what the formula is, but if you don't get a feeling from it, you might as well put it in the computer and let the computer do it. And maybe, you know, the computer for some people might have a feeling. But to me, music is a celebration of life. And I think life has to do with what it is that we feel about living from moment to moment. It expresses certain things for us, perhaps vicariously. You know, I listen to Billie Holiday and she takes me a certain place. Mm-hmm. I listen to Miles, he takes me a certain place. See, I can listen to Dave Brubeck and he'll take me a certain place with whatever it is that he's doing. Morello with the solo, you know, on Take Five, take you to a certain place. See, so what am I saying?
Well, it sounds like not so much the details in themselves that you know they're useful as an analytical tool,
right?
But maybe what you're saying is, you know, when you go to play, it's the way that the feeling of it and the way that it brings us to life.
It's a science, but it's a science and an art also. And you're going to have to talk about what you mean by art, you know? It's expression. Mm-hmm. See, you can take a number three and you can look at three and say, does three have an expression? Okay, three what?
Blind mice.
Three blind mice. See? But then there you go. One, two, three. But we're singing
it. I could have said the Magi.
Well, sing the Magi.
Three kings.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, you could say the three kings. But see, when I think of the three kings, I think of the three kings bringing frankincense and myrrh to the Christ child. Mm-hmm. So then, as a musician, if I had to think of the three magi, what would I be thinking in terms of what either the three magi felt when they brought the frankincense and myrrh to the Christ child, or how I felt about what the three magi were doing when they brought it to the Christ child? So then we get into, let's say, religion, and what does religion mean to us in terms of feeling, and what does religion mean when you start talking about religion? And you know, one of the definitions is that it binds you to God. And then, you know, we go into another place in terms of how that makes us feel in this dimension as human beings, in terms of where we go after we leave here, mm-hmm. and we're no longer in this dimension, you see, of what we call life. So I'm talking about like post-life death, what happens then. Mm-hmm. See, so we think about
being bound. So that three took you to quite a few places.
Took me to quite a few places, yeah. But you could take any number and, you know, right. You can think of numbers, but it's not necessarily the numbers that are alive, so to speak.
Right, and also that's not what's in your book.
Right, well.
You're extrapolating.
Yeah.
Which is what you do.
Yeah.
Which is what is.
But still, you know, you can make certain comments, you know, to students so that they can think about some things perhaps, maybe in a scientific way, which means that if you put one and one together, we get two, you see, or if you boil water, you know, at 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you get steam. See, so maybe there's a way that you can express what they feel in relationship to some kind of a scientific process. But the process itself is not necessarily, you know, one and one makes two, because now, see, the other part of it is this too. We can start thinking about science and we can start thinking about music, and you start thinking about string theory and vibrations. So that's what we're made out of. So the point is, yeah, you can, you know, think about physics and you can think about energy and you can put them into formulas. But when it comes down to the formulas being transfused, is that a word, put through us?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's another situation. You know, right. If I touch you, I feel you. Now, we can talk about, you know, the heat that goes from my hand to your hand and what's going on, and perhaps we could, you know, analyze that and identify that, you see, on some kind of a machine, you know, that would measure heat. But still, it's not necessarily those numbers that make you and me communicate.
Right, right, right. It's a deeper level.
It's a deeper level, it's something that we don't even quite understand yet.
Yeah.
How we're made.
But I think, right, but how we got here is the process of making music. And getting to that other level within the feelings that the sounds evoke.
That's one of the things that we do, that we need.
Yeah.
And that's why people do it. I don't know of a society, and maybe you do, that doesn't have music in its culture. I don't care where you go.
Right. You played on this record a couple of years ago called Unit Structures.
Mm-hmm.
The piano player.
What's his name again?
Cecil Taylor.
Yeah.
It's 1966.
Cecil Percival Taylor.
And there were two sessions in the same year, 1966. So I want to play a little bit from the record Unit Structures just for a second. This is this piece called Steps. Structures. You were laughing.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it's almost like a mini big band, right?
Right.
And it's kind of a unique instrumentation that's these days not so unusual, but for then that must have been kind of a revelation to be. I mean, you'd been playing with Cecil Taylor already for a little while when that session happened, right?
I was 66, right?
That was 66.
I must have started playing with Cecil probably in 65 when we did that date in 66.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, I was doing some other stuff.
But did this band have a lot of gigs together?
No.
Was it not a lot of performances?
No.
Like playing at the loft, playing at Cecil's house?
One or two. Well, they weren't gigs, no. They were rehearsals, maybe.
Uh-huh.
We rehearsed, you know, weekly. See, sometimes a couple of times a week.
But also, like, that was just one gig that you had at the time. You were working with all kinds of other people.
Yeah,
all through that period.
Well, yeah, I had to live, I had to eat. But you see, the thing about it too is, I love music.
Yeah.
So I was playing music with
but
a lot of different people.
Differently in that band than you did in a lot of other bands that you were in. At that time, let's say. Is that fair to say, or is that not really?
No, yeah, it's fair to say, but look, what you just heard,
yeah.
What the hell else was I supposed to play?
Wow.
So I had to figure that one out. You know, what we do has to do with intelligence also. How do you work this problem out?
So would you say that Cecil presented that problem just by the way he was playing and the way he presented the music? Or did he ever say to you, I want you to do this kind of thing?
Let me see. I worked with Cecil during this period for 11 years straight. He never made one gig. Well, no. He did do one job from the beginning when I started working with him. And I think it had to be 65. And I worked with him for 11 years, so that had to be 65, 75, till about 76.
Uh-huh.
Only one time did I say to him, Cecil, what would you want me to do here? So he said, yeah, we'll play a 3-5 or 5-against whatever. That was it. And he never, if I thought I was doing that, he never said, no, I don't mean that, I mean this. He never said a word to me about what I was playing. Play whatever you want. And then, see, with him, it was always about absorbing what was given or presented to him in relationship to the members of the unit, not necessarily about what he had written for them or he had them playing. See, because what he would do is he would sit at the piano and he would have certain things that he would play and that he would want, let's say, Jimmy to play. And then he would give them the notes. He would tell them to go from A to A flat, up to C, down to G, you know, to G sharp, go up to F. And Jimmy would write these things down. And everybody would write that down, mm-hmm. You see. So then when we would rehearse, he would play certain things on the piano that related to what it was that he was giving them in terms of, let's say, the melodic or maybe even harmonic structure.
Yeah.
But for me, he just let me play whatever it was that I heard. So In my own head, I felt that I had a responsibility to embellish what they were doing to make it sound better insofar as how I was playing the drums. So I was not going to destroy, and drummers can do that. And I'd say that, and maybe I shouldn't use that term destroy, but drummers can turn some music around. They can make music, I can't say unmusical, but they can do some other things, certain drummers, all right? So I always felt that I had to play something that was genial, congenial, made them feel good about what they were playing, added to the composition, made me feel good, and also was part of what I felt the tradition was. With all of that stuff that I had learned coming through to that point, being that.
A lot of that music is really dynamic, like gets really sparse and empty and quiet. You lay out for long periods on certain pieces. Other pieces get quite loud and excited and raucous. And then they seem to sort of change on a dime. Like in a moment's notice, the music changes in timbrally and in terms of feeling and in terms of what the expression is. And so if I'm understanding you right, you're saying that you just, you know, reacted to the situation at hand the best you could, and that was what came out.
Precisely. It has to do with respect.
Yeah.
And how can I make this, you know, a better...
But also deep listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a, on the record that you made about 6 months later, I guess, in October of 66, Conquistador. And there's some playing on here where, to my ears, it sounds like everyone's playing in time, but nobody's literally playing that time feel necessarily at the same pace or pulse or meter. And yet there's a feeling of flow. And it sounds to me like something that might have been new right around that time, and that, you know, players today, we sort of deal with that. You know, we've heard that. We know how to think that way. But in the context of this tune, it's kind of remarkable. I'll just play a little bit of what I'm talking about. Thank you.
I remember playing that. And I remember what I was thinking when I was doing it.
And what was that?
I was thinking Latin.
Uh-huh.
Bang,
Conquistador. I guess it's a Spanish name. Nothing to do with that.
Because, see, you could take that. I don't know what Cecil was talking about when he talked about conquistador. He could have been saying that we were the conquistadors. But I'm not, in terms of what I knew the conquistadors did to the Native Americans who were in South America, it wasn't very nice.
That's a polite way of putting it.
You know what I'm saying? So, okay, conquistador. But, fine, people used all kinds of...
So that you weren't coming from the word aspect of it. You were coming from, I hear what is happening in this music, and here's the vibe that I want to put on it.
And it's very interesting that you bring it up, because if he was sitting at this table right now, I'd say, hey, you know what, man? You know, I never asked you, why did you pick the term conquistadors for this? We had a lot of conversations, but never a conversation, you know, about the title. Cecil, you know, read all sorts of stuff, and he comes with all kinds of ideas coming from different places.
He was a poet.
That he also applied to the music. So when he was playing that kind of rhythm, you see, and playing how he would play that, those melodies, now he was making those leaps, you see. I said to myself, now I know what can fit with this. And I just started, you know, playing some kind of a Latin stuff, even though it was an extrapolated Latin.
Yeah, and really free. And nobody is metrically necessarily hooked up. And as you move through the piano solo, he goes through a lot of different permutations of whatever it was that hinted you in that direction in the first place, and then you sort of morph with him as it moves along,
right?
In a very beautiful, effective way.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see the other part of what we're talking about is time, and one can think, you know, of time metrically, which is how we think about it most of the time in terms of how we deal with each other. With this society, when we need to do certain things with each other. So, you know, the time might be, let's say 20 minutes to 4, fine. But if that wasn't there, if the clock wasn't there, and we weren't dealing with time in that way, one could simply think of time as the duration of that which changes. Things just go from one period to another. You see, if you're in the country and you're out there with roosters, 5 a.m. in the morning, you hear cock-a-doodle-doo, cock-a-doodle-doo. The rooster's not telling you it's 5 o'clock in the morning. He's doing what it does, what it does, because you know time has changed. The sun's coming up or whatever. And then at night, everything gets quiet. So the other thing is too, when you think of rhythm. Rhythm doesn't necessarily have to be separated. It could be like water. It could be flowing. It's still a rhythm. It's moving. Yeah. It's got shape.
Right.
But you don't see the water being separated. Unless,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And when you watch a river flow downstream, it's different at every minute, and yet it's kind of always the same.
That's right. And you get these rhythms, etc. See.
But again, you know, that's not something that you and Cecil talked about or anybody in the band. Sounds like he gave people little cells of information, and he had things that he would play, and then everybody would just go from there.
Yeah, but Dave, just let me say this though. If he had another drummer like Sonny Murray, that music would have sounded much differently. It would have been much different than from the way I played it. Or somebody like Shannon Jackson.
Yeah.
See, or who else played with him? Crowell.
Jackson Crowell.
Jackson Crowell.
Yeah.
It would have been different.
Right, right. Of course. But I also feel like Cecil's music was strong enough that it was going to have that Cecil Taylor personality regardless. It was up to all the musicians to figure out how to best serve that world.
Right.
And if they could understand it and figure out how to interact with it and add something of their own in a perfect world.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, your record, you're doing that in a very different way, but at the same time, you know, I was attracted to this piece called TGD from La Broba that the three of you created together. And it has a different vibe than the other pieces. Mm-hmm. But it's, you hear everyone's personality so strongly and clearly. Mm-hmm. With a TGD, what's the derivation of the name?
Trumpet, guitar, and drums.
Oh, I can't believe I didn't, yeah. I thought it was going to be the generation derivation.
Sometimes.
Trumpet, guitar, and drums. Well, that yeah. That's a lot simpler.
What I knew, what else works. Was there? Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me about all this music. I feel like, a veil has been lifted.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a beautiful record.
Thank you.
And looking forward to a lot more things. And I know you have a big birthday coming up. So, but I'm going to see you. We're going to be playing.
Yeah, right.
So, Andrew, this was fantastic.
Gracias, amigo.
Gracias a usted, señor.
Bueno.
And since we're now acquainted in Spanish, I'll say thank you, and we'll go out and listen to a little bit of TGD.
All right.